A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking in simple terms what DNA actually is. Then he's got this layered follow-up. Does our DNA change over our lifetime? And when a couple conceives, is the child getting a snapshot of the father's DNA at that exact moment? Or are these fixed expressions passed down? And then he tacks on a historical curveball. What are the most conspicuous milestone years in DNA research? And when was it first discovered? It's basically four questions stacked in a trench coat, pretending to be one prompt.
They're good questions. The third one especially, the snapshot or fixed expression framing. That's the kind of thing people assume they know the answer to, and then you actually think about it for 30 seconds and realize there's real depth there.
Where do we start? What is DNA? Simple terms, no textbook preamble.
DNA is a string of four chemical letters, A, T, C, and G, that stores instructions for building and running a living organism. About 3 billion of these letters in the human genome arranged in a specific order across 23 pairs of chromosomes. If you stretch the DNA in a single human cell end to end, it would be about 2 meters long, all coiled into a nucleus about 6 micrometers across.
2 meters of string stuffed into something smaller than a dust mite. That's already absurd.
The PACI mechanism is genuinely one of the most underappreciated engineering feats in biology. Histone proteins act as spools. DNA wraps around them like thread, and then that whole structure gets folded and refolded at multiple scales. It's like taking a rope the length of a car and cramming it into a poppy seed without tangling.
Somehow the cell still manages to find and read specific sections on demand.
That's the transcription machinery, proteins that unspool just the right segment, copy it into RNA, and then let it spool back up. The access problem is harder than finding a specific sentence in a library where every book is simultaneously being used as furniture.
That's the what. Now the does it change question. I've heard both answers, yes and no, depending on who's talking and what axe they're grinding.
The short answer is yes. DNA changes over a lifetime in multiple distinct ways. And this is where most popular science coverage collapses a bunch of different phenomena into one blur. Let me separate them. First, somatic mutations. These are changes to the DNA sequence in individual cells, acquired as you age. Every time a cell divides, it has to copy its entire genome, and the copying machinery makes errors. The error rate is extraordinarily low, about one mistake per 100 million base pairs per division, but you have trillions of cells and some of them divide constantly.
It's a numbers game. Low error rate times astronomical number of divisions equals a meaningful accumulation.
Skin cells, intestinal lining cells, blood stem cells, they're all dividing throughout your life, and each division is a chance for a typo. By the time you're 60, a typical epithelial cell might carry a few thousand mutations that weren't there at birth. Most are harmless. They land in non-coding regions or don't change protein function. But some can be drivers for cancer, which is why cancer incidence rises with age. It's not that aging causes cancer directly, it's that you've accumulated more rolls of the dice.
That's somatic cells. What about the ones that matter for the inheritance question, the germline?
That's the second layer, and it's the one directly relevant to the snapshot question. Sperm and egg cells are made through a process called meiosis, and the DNA in those cells does not remain frozen from birth. In men, sperm-producing stem cells divide continuously throughout life, about 23 divisions per year. Each division introduces the same tiny risk of a copying error. So a man's sperm at age 40 carries, on average, about 25 to 30 more new mutations than his sperm at age 25.
That's a real number. 25 to 30 new mutations that weren't there when he was younger.
The research backs this up. A landmark study in Nature in 2012, led by Kari Stefansson at Decode Genetics in Iceland, sequenced the genomes of 78 parent-child trios and found that a father passes on roughly 2 new mutations for every year of his age at conception. A 20-year-old father passes about 25 new mutations to his child. A 40-year-old father passes about 65. The mother's age has almost no effect on the mutation count. Her eggs were formed before she was born and sit in a kind of suspended animation.
The child gets the father's DNA as it existed at the moment of conception, typos and all. Not some pristine original copy from his birth.
It is a snapshot. A high-fidelity snapshot of the father's germline DNA at that moment in time, complete with the accumulated scribbles of a lifetime of cell divisions. And that's just the sequence changes. There's a third layer that's even more dynamic. Epigenetics.
Epigenetics. The dimmer switch, not the wiring.
I like that. Chemical tags, primarily methyl groups, that attach to DNA and change how genes are expressed without changing the underlying sequence. And these tags change constantly throughout life. Diet, stress, exercise, smoking, toxin exposure. All of these can add or remove epigenetic marks. Some are stable for years. Some cycle daily with circadian rhythms.
Can those be passed to children too?
Mostly, no. There's a massive epigenetic reprogramming event that happens shortly after fertilization. Most of the parental methylation marks get wiped and reset, but not all. There's a phenomenon called genomic imprinting where certain genes escape the wipe and retain parental epigenetic marks. And there's growing evidence from animal studies that some environmentally induced epigenetic changes can persist across generations, though the mechanism is debated and the effect size in humans is unclear. I'm not sure about this part, but the best evidence suggests it's real, but subtler than the headlines claim.
Epigenetic inheritance. Sounds like the kind of phrase that launches 1,000 wellness podcasts and approximately 0 controlled trials.
That's unfair, but not entirely wrong. The field has a reproducibility problem. But the core phenomenon, that DNA sequence accumulates mutations and epigenetic marks shift, is rock solid. Is rock solid. So to answer the prompt directly, yes, DNA changes. In somatic cells, it mutates and accumulates epigenetic drift. In the germline, it mutates at a predictable rate, and those mutations are faithfully transmitted. The child gets the father's DNA as it stood at the moment of conception, not some platonic ideal of his genome.
Which means, in a very literal sense, that older fathers are passing down slightly different genetic material than they would have if they'd had the same child 10 years earlier.
Those mutations aren't just neutral. Paternal age is correlated with increased risk of certain conditions in offspring. Autism spectrum disorder and schizophrenia are the two most studied. A 2016 study in JAMA Psychiatry found that children born to fathers over 45 had about a 3.5 times higher risk of autism compared to fathers in their early 20s. The absolute risk is still low. We're talking about going from roughly 1% to 3 or 4%, but the relative increase is substantial and has been replicated across multiple large cohorts.
That's a number that should probably be more widely known. So we've got somatic mutations, germline mutations that accumulate with paternal age, and epigenetic shifts, most of which get wiped, but some don't. DNA is not a fixed blueprint. It's more like a document that's being lightly edited every single day, and then the edited version gets photocopied and handed to the next generation,
with the father's age determining how many red pin marks are on the photocopy. The mother's contribution is different. Her eggs are old in a literal chronological sense, formed during fetal development, and they accumulate damage to the cellular machinery rather than new sequence mutations. That's why chromosomal abnormalities like trisomy 21 increase with maternal age. Different mechanism, same directional effect, older parents, more genetic risk.
Two routes to the same destination. Biology loves redundancy in all the wrong ways.
Now the fourth part of the prompt, the history. When was DNA first discovered, and what are the conspicuous milestone years?
And I'm guessing the answer to when was it first discovered depends on what you count as discovered.
The substance itself, DNA as a physical molecule, was first isolated in 1869 by a Swiss physician named Friedrich Miescher. He was working in a lab in Tübingen, Germany, studying the chemical composition of white blood cells. He'd collect pus from used surgical bandages, I'm not making this up, and from that he extracted a phosphorus-rich substance from the cell nuclei that he called nuclein.
Pus from bandages, the glamour of foundational science.
Mischer had no idea what it did. He speculated it might be a storehouse for phosphorus, or maybe something structural. The idea that it carried hereditary information was decades away. For the next 75 years, most biologists thought proteins were the genetic material. Proteins are more complex, 20 amino acids instead of 4 bases, so they seemed like a better candidate for encoding the complexity of life.
The 4-letter alphabet seemed too simple.
And that assumption held until 1944, which is the first truly conspicuous milestone year. Oswald Avery, along with Colin McLeod and McLeod McCarty, published a paper showing that DNA, not protein, was the transforming principle that carried genetic information in bacteria. They took a pathogenic strain of pneumococcus, extracted its DNA, and showed that the purified DNA alone could transform a harmless strain into a pathogenic one.
The world yawned.
The Avery experiment is now considered one of the most important papers in biology, but it didn't win a Nobel. Avery died in 1955, and even though the Nobel Committee later admitted they'd made a mistake not awarding him, the rules don't allow posthumous prizes. The recognition went instead to the next milestone.
1953. Watson and Crick.
Watson and Crick, with Rosalind Franklin's X-ray crystallography data, specifically photo 51 showing the double helix structure. That's the moment DNA entered the public imagination, and it's the one everyone knows. But the structure alone didn't explain how it worked. What made the paper revolutionary was the throwaway line at the end. It has not escaped our notice that the specific pairing we have postulated immediately suggests a possible copying mechanism for the genetic material.
One of the great understatements in scientific literature. It has not escaped our notice.
Francis Crick later admitted they put that line in as a way of staking a claim on the functional implications without having to prove them yet. It was a scientific land grab disguised as modesty. Died of ovarian cancer in 1958 at 37, before the Nobel was awarded in 1962. Watson, Crick, and Maurice Wilkins shared it. Franklin's contribution was essential. Her X-ray crystallography provided the physical evidence for the helical structure, but the credit was distributed unevenly, and the way Watson portrayed her in his memoir, The Double Helix, was, let's say, ungenerous. The history has been substantially revised in her favor since then.
That's the foundation. What comes next in the milestone timeline?
1961-66, cracking the genetic code. Multiple labs, but Marshall Nirenberg gets the headline for the first breakthrough. He showed that the sequence UUU codes for the amino acid phenylalanine. Over the next 5 years, the entire code was deciphered, which 3-letter combinations correspond to which amino acids and where the stop signals are. It's the Rosetta Stone of molecular biology. By 1966, you could take a DNA sequence and predict the protein it would produce.
Then a long gap before the next conspicuous year.
1977. Fred Sanger develops chain termination sequencing, which becomes the dominant method for reading DNA for the next 30 years. Sanger sequencing is what enabled the Human Genome Project. Sanger himself won 2 Nobel Prizes in chemistry, one for protein sequencing in 1958, one for DNA sequencing in 1980. He's one of only 4 people to win 2 Nobels in the same category.
The Human Genome Project itself?
Launched in 1990, completed in 2003, ahead of schedule and under budget, which is almost unheard of for a massive government science project. It cost about $2.7 billion and involved thousands of scientists across 20 institutions in 6 countries. The announcement of the first draft in June 2000 was a joint press conference with Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and the project leaders. That was a conspicuous moment, heads of state treating a biology paper like a moon landing.
Now we have people spitting in the tubes and getting their genome back for a couple $100s.
That's the post-genome revolution. 2005, the launch of Next Generation Sequencing, or NGS, which parallelized the process and dropped the cost by orders of magnitude. The $1,000 genome became a reality around 2015. The $100 genome is here now. We're heading toward the $10 genome.
The conspicuous years, to summarize, 1869 for the isolation of DNA, 1944 for proving it's the genetic material, 1953 for the double helix, 1961-66 for cracking the code, 1977 for Sanger sequencing, 2003 for the Human Genome Project completion, and then the NGS revolution starting in 2005.
I'd add 2 more. 2012. That's when CRISPR-Cas9 was first demonstrated as a programmable gene editing tool in a paper by Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuelle Charpentier. That changed everything. Before CRISPR, gene editing was possible but slow, expensive, and imprecise. After CRISPR, you could target a specific gene, cut it, and modify it with a precision that was previously science fiction. They won the Nobel in Chemistry in 2020. 2022, the first complete, gap-free human genome sequence was published. The original Human Genome Project had left about 8% of the genome unsequenced, mostly repetitive regions around the centromeres and telomeres that were technically impossible to assemble with the methods of the time. A consortium called the Telomere to Telomere Consortium, or T2T, finally closed those gaps using new long-read sequencing technologies. The final 8% turned out to contain about 2,000 genes, and a lot of structural elements we're still trying to understand.
For 20 years, we were walking around with what we thought was the complete human genome, and it was missing 8%.
Biology is humbling like that. Every time we think we've got the book read, we realize we've been skipping entire chapters.
Let me pull us back to something you said earlier about the paternal age effect. 25 to 30 extra mutations at 40 versus 25. That's a concrete number, but it's small in the context of 3 billion base pairs. Why does it matter?
Because the mutations aren't randomly distributed in terms of their effects. Most of the genome is non-coding. It doesn't directly specify proteins, so a mutation there might do nothing. But when a mutation lands in a coding region, or in a regulatory element that controls when and where a gene is expressed, it can have outsized effects, and some genes are particularly sensitive. There's a set of genes associated with brain development that are unusually large and complex, which makes them statistically more likely to be hit by random mutations. That's one hypothesis for why paternal age correlates with neurodevelopmental conditions. The genes involved are simply bigger targets.
Bigger targets for random typos. That's elegantly simple.
There's another angle. The mutations we're talking about in sperm are de novo mutations. They appear for the first time in that sperm cell and didn't exist in the father's own body. But they exist in every cell of the child that results, because that sperm's genome becomes the template for the entire organism. So a single mutation in a single sperm becomes a whole body mutation in the offspring.
Which loops back to the snapshot question. The snapshot captures not just the inherited genome, but the fresh typos introduced during sperm production.
Those typos then become part of the child's permanent record. If that child is male, he might pass them on to his own children, plus his own new set of age-accumulated mutations. The mutation rate isn't just a curiosity, it's the raw material for evolution. Every new mutation in the germline is a potential evolutionary experiment, most of them neutral or slightly harmful, a tiny fraction potentially beneficial.
When we talk about DNA being fixed, that's wrong on both timescales. Over a lifetime, it drifts. Over generations, it accumulates changes that become permanent features of lineages.
Even calling it fixed at the species level is wrong when you consider horizontal gene transfer in bacteria, or the fact that about 8% of the human genome is composed of endogenous retroviruses, ancient viral DNA that integrated into our ancestors' genomes and got passed down. We're walking around with fossilized viruses in our genetic code. Some of those viral sequences have been repurposed. There's one called syncytin that's essential for placental development. Without an ancient viral infection, mammals might not have placentas.
We are, in part, domesticated viruses.
In a very literal sense, the boundary between our DNA and foreign DNA is blurrier than we like to think.
Let me ask you something about the historical timeline. You mentioned Misha in 1869. What was the gap between his discovery and anyone even suspecting DNA had something to do with heredity?
About 75 years. Mendel's work on pea plants was published in 1866, just 3 years before Miescher's discovery, but it was largely ignored until it was rediscovered around 1900. Even once Mendelism was accepted, the physical nature of the gene was a complete mystery. The chromosome theory of inheritance, the idea that genes are located on chromosomes, was developed by Thomas Hunt Morgan and his students at Columbia in the 1910s using fruit flies. They won the Nobel in 1933. but they still didn't know whether the genetic material was the DNA or the proteins in the chromosomes.
For decades, the smartest biologists in the world were staring at the molecule of heredity and didn't recognize it.
The reason is instructive. They were looking for complexity. Proteins are built from 20 different amino acids, which can be combined in essentially infinite sequences. DNA has only 4 bases. It seemed too simple to encode the complexity of a human being. It's like assuming a message must be written in a rich, expressive language and overlooking the possibility that it's written in binary.
4 letters, but the words can be any length. The combinatorial explosion does the work.
4 to the power of n, where n is the length of the sequence, grows faster than any practical mind can grasp. A sequence of just 10 bases has 4 to the 10, over a million, possible combinations. The human genome is 3 billion bases long. The number of possible sequences is larger than the number of atoms in the observable universe by an incomprehensible margin.
Simplicity was the point. A 4-letter alphabet is easier to copy accurately than a 20-letter one.
That's exactly the insight Watson and Crick had. The double helix structure immediately suggests a copying mechanism because each strand serves as a template for the other. A pairs with T, C pairs with G. Split the helix, and each half contains all the information needed to reconstruct the full molecule. It's the most elegant data storage system ever invented, and it evolved by blind trial and error over billions of years.
You mentioned CRISPR earlier. 2012, Doudna and Charpentier. What exactly did they demonstrate that was new? Gene editing existed before, didn't it?
The previous generation of tools, zinc finger nucleases and TALENs, worked, but they required designing and building a custom protein for each target sequence. That took months and cost tens of thousands of dollars per experiment. CRISPR uses a guide RNA molecule to find the target sequence, and RNA is cheap and easy to synthesize. You can design a new guide RNA in an afternoon and have it synthesized for under $100. The Cas9 protein, the scissors, is the same every time. You just swap the guide.
It turned gene editing from a bespoke tailoring operation into a print-on-demand service.
That's exactly the right metaphor. And the democratization has been staggering. High school students are doing CRISPR experiments in biology class now. The barrier to entry collapsed.
Which raises the ethical questions that everyone's been arguing about for the last decade. Germline editing, designer babies, all of that.
Those arguments got real in 2018 when a Chinese researcher named He Jiankui announced he'd used CRISPR to edit the CCR5 gene in human embryos, resulting in the birth of twin girls. He claimed he was trying to make them resistant to HIV. The scientific community almost unanimously condemned him. Not because the goal was bad, but because the safety data wasn't there, the informed consent process was questionable, and he'd jumped past every ethical safeguard the field had been building. He went to prison for 3 years.
The first CRISPR babies. And it was a rogue operation. That's not the milestone anyone wanted.
It set the field back in some ways, because it made legitimate germline research harder to fund and harder to get approved. But it also forced a global conversation that had been theoretical to become very practical. We're still having that conversation. The WHO issued a governance framework in 2021. Multiple countries have passed laws. But the tools keep improving and the pressure to use them. For disease prevention, if not enhancement, is going to keep building.
We've covered what DNA is, how it changes, what gets passed on, and the milestone years. Let me ask one more thing about the changes over a lifetime piece. Is there a practical way to measure someone's DNA changes? Can you take a snapshot at age 30 and another at age 50 and compare?
You can, and people have. There are studies that do longitudinal whole genome sequencing on the same individuals, but it's not something you'd do clinically. It's still expensive, and the interpretation is complex. What is becoming clinically relevant is something related but different, measuring the epigenetic clock.
The epigenetic clock.
Also called the Horvath clock, after Steve Horvath, who published the key paper in 2013. Certain positions in the genome gain or lose methylation at predictable rates as people age. By measuring the methylation status at a few hundred of these positions, you can estimate someone's biological age with remarkable accuracy within about 3 years of their chronological age. And when the epigenetic age is higher than the chronological age, that's associated with increased risk of age-related diseases and all-cause mortality.
You can be 40 chronologically and 50 epigenetically.
And that's a bad sign. It's been linked to stress, smoking, poor diet, and a bunch of other factors. There are companies now selling epigenetic age tests direct to consumers. The science is real, but the actionable information is still limited. Knowing your epigenetic age is older doesn't necessarily tell you what to do about it, beyond the standard health advice you already know.
Your cells are aging faster than your calendar. Also, eat more vegetables.
But the research is moving fast, and epigenetic clocks are increasingly used as endpoints in anti-aging clinical trials. If you want to test whether a drug slows aging, you need a biomarker that changes faster than mortality, and the epigenetic clock is currently the best candidate we have.
The field has gone from, what is this gooey substance in pus, to, we can measure how fast you're aging by reading chemical tags on your DNA in about 150 years.
The pace is accelerating. The first nuclear clock was just built by physicists. That was in the news this week. The precision of biological measurement is following the same trajectory as physical measurement. We're entering an era where we can read the genome, edit it, and monitor its changes in real time. The philosophical implications are as big as the medical ones.
Which brings me back to the inheritance question. If a father's DNA accumulates mutations with age, and we can now sequence genomes cheaply, is anyone studying whether the children of older fathers have measurably different genomes than siblings born when the father was younger?
Yes, and the answer is, they do. There was a 2017 study that sequenced the genomes of over 1,500 Icelandic families, three generations, and directly measured the number of new mutations in children as a function of paternal age. The correlation was almost perfectly linear. Every additional year of paternal age adds about 1.5 new mutations to the child's genome. So two siblings born 10 years apart to the same father will differ by about 15 mutations that came exclusively from the father's aging germline.
That's a small number, but they're not the same 15. The younger sibling might get a mutation in a brain development gene. The older sibling might get one in a non-coding region. It's a lottery.
A lottery with a slowly increasing number of tickets. Most of the tickets are blank, a few have consequences, and the ticket count goes up every year.
That's a sobering way to think about delayed parenthood. Not judgment, just biology.
It's worth noting that the absolute risks remain low for most conditions. The paternal age effect is real and measurable, but for any individual couple, the odds of a healthy child are still overwhelmingly high. It's a population-level effect that matters for public health more than for individual decision-making.
We should probably wrap this. The prompt asks for simple terms, conspicuous years, and the snapshot question. I think we've delivered.
DNA is a four-letter chemical instruction manual that changes throughout life through mutations and epigenetic shifts. Fathers pass on a snapshot of their germline DNA at the moment of conception, complete with age-accumulated typos. The discovery timeline runs from Miescher's pus-derived nucleon in 1869 to the gap-free genome of 2022, with about a dozen conspicuous milestones in between.
If you're keeping score at home, you're walking around with fossilized viruses in your genome. Your biological age might not match your calendar age. And every year you age, your future children's DNA gets slightly more edited. Biology. Consistently unsettling. Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The Ethiopian game of Jenna, a form of field hockey played at Christmas, takes its name from the Amharic word for Christmas itself. Jena, also spelled Jenna or Ledet, derived from the Greek genesis, meaning birth. The name traveled across linguistic boundaries for centuries before landing in the highlands, where it now describes both a religious holiday and a sport played with curved wooden sticks and a wooden ball.
Christmas hockey in Ethiopia is etymologically Greek. This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you got something out of this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the you're hosting deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.